You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
All right, the second session is essentially trying to take this practice and ask a question which has been asked by all the panelists this morning in one way or the other, which is, how does it actually work, this artistic activism thing that we've been talking about? This has been a question which has fascinated us at the Center for Artistic Activism. When we first started 8 or 9 years ago, as Steve alluded to, our first actual work that we did was asking artists this question. It seemed like a very simple question, which is, we found artists and activists whose work we admired, and we would say, well, how does it work? And of course, that isn't a simple question at all. Because immediately when you ask, how does it work, then the whole question comes up of, what does it mean to have art actually work? And then the question becomes, how do you measure this thing, which is called the work that art does? And so this question has intrigued us since the beginning of the Center for Artistic Activism. A number of people on the panel before talked about the training work that we do. But in addition to the training work we also do research. And this has been at the core of our research, is trying to figure out how to develop a way to talk about this, a vocabulary to think about art working. And also, and this is a word that probably is going to raise hackles, coming up with the metrics in order to measure this in such a way that is appropriate for the practice. And that's the key here. What are the measurements appropriate for the practice? And the measurements that artists themselves, either implicitly or explicitly, working with. So I have this amazing panel up here, which is going to help us puzzle through some of these things. Very quickly, what we're going to do is kind of, the order's all messed up anyway. Okay, but we're going to start with Jan Cohen-Cruz, who is an author and a scholar, and is, I mean, there's so many things that Jan has done, but in this moment, her subject position is going to be, she's the director of field research for A Blade of Grass. She also does other evaluations of other partnerships as well. Second is going to be Pam Corza, who's all the way to my right. And she co-directs Animating Democracy, which is a program of Americans for the Arts that inspires, informs, promotes, and connects arts and culture as contributors to a larger social world. Pam's work has been very influential on how we've started to think about arts and activism. It's one of the first work I've seen out there that is taking this question of what does it mean to work very seriously. To my immediate right is George Perloff, who is marketing communications consultant, currently based in Brussels. We brought him in for this. And I mean, while he is based in Brussels, he also does work with in New York as well. He is an ex-VP of research for the Ad Council. And for the past couple of years, he's been working with us at the Center for Artistic Activism in order to figure out how to make sense of this thing, artistic activism, and its impact. And last but not least, certainly, is to my immediate left is Risa Wilson, who is probably better known as a founder of the Laundromat Project, which is one of the most successful of these projects out there. But she also has a paying job as the inaugural director of philanthropy for the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have the same formats before. We have these to keep people on track. We're just going to go through the panel, and I'll probably ask a pointed question at the end of each, but then we'll open it up. Okay?
Great.
So we begin.
So first, thank you so much for having me, everybody. The Stevens. I love the name, The Stevens. The Open Society. So I consider myself so lucky to follow that panel. At first, it was so terrific. And secondly, I don't have to explain what a blade of grass does. I do want to say something. Stephen spoke briefly about language. What's the language we use? I do want to say something about the fact that I'm director of field research, not of evaluation. We're not being coy. We think language is very important. We recognize that language is very important, and that if we're an organization that's trying to support artists and the other people who do this work, we don't want to bring along baggage of people thinking that someone is looking over their shoulder, assuming that maybe they're out drinking with the money we gave them. Not that they might not ever do that, but field research also suggests that we're co-researching with them. This is a collaboration. Given the number of stakeholders that we've all been talking about in this field, we have to research various people and what their participation is to see who is this work benefiting. That's a very important question. So obviously, we talk a lot with the artists, we talk with the participants, we talk with partner organizations, and we observe. So it's not that the person who's doing this kind of synthesis, this writing, has no point of view. Of course, she or he does, but it's a point of view that's very informed by the research, and that's important to us. Then I would say, especially because of activist art, we're dealing in multiple ecosystems. So not just participants within a project, but how can anyone have enough expertise to go into depth about what will some of the different topics we've heard already, in addition to art and why we're using art as part of a partnership, criminal justice, community development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes then even more important to ask, and this is really my focus in these brief remarks for today, who is the field researcher or the evaluator? In my job, I don't do all the writing, but I do work with all the people who do the writing, and I do some of the writing. A book that made a real impact on me and on this idea was co-edited by Pam Corza, there to the right, in 2005, Critical Perspectives. And what they did, it's a great book. You can find it on their website. What they did was they took three projects that had been funded through Animating Democracy, and they had three writers from different fields write about each project. So for example, one of them was Dell'Arte, the theater company on the West Coast, north of San Francisco. They were doing something to deal with the casinos. A casino had opened up on Native American land. So on the one hand, Dell'Arte wanted a theater critic. They're a theater company. And so they got a theater critic. On the other hand, they wanted someone from the Native American community who'd been following the effect, the very bad effect, of casinos on Native American land. They got that. And they wanted someone writing about community cultural development because there are any number of issues about the diverse people who live in that neck of the woods. And reading those three essays is quite fascinating. They each are emphasizing different kinds of goals, all of which are part of the project. Then the director of that, of the show they made, and of the company, got to respond, which I also thought was lovely. So they did that three times. So that's this question, and it's recognizing that based on who your writer is, what will be evaluated, what will be lifted up, will be different. Now, you can deal with that partly by the research you do, but that's very important to understand, and that's absolutely endemic. It's part of our field. It's part of what makes it so much fun and so fascinating. We're always learning, but on the other hand, it's a challenge that comes with the territory. Then there are specific issues about who is writing, who is following the project. We have our field researchers, our fellows have a one-year... We have an active relationship with them for 1 year, and that work is followed for the year, and that's when we're, and that's what we write about, that 1 year, that one piece of what might be what usually is a much larger project. Nevertheless, who comes into that project for 1 year will affect it, right? So, for example, when Adaku Utah, who directs Harriet's Apothecary, which involves healing rituals for African-American women, when she got one of our fellowships, I started picturing myself, my white self, sitting in the corner of the room with African-American women going through very, very vulnerable experiences and emotions. And I thought, really? They don't have time to get to know me. I would love to get to sit in on this work, but am I really the best just what I'll do when I walk in the room? So I asked Deborah, can we talk about someone else maybe? And she said, yeah. And so when I said that, when I met with the doctor and I asked her who might she really like and why I wasn't so sure I was the best one, as interested as I was, she was floored. She said she had never had a funder ask her who was going to evaluate her work. That's so interesting to me, because what's this neutrality we think we're getting if we don't ask the artist? You know, I mean, no, there's not neutrality. The question is, which way will someone be leaning? How much do they know? And in work like this, we often need the person who knows a lot, because it's hard to describe. It's not obvious where the art is often. And indeed, she indeed got an African-American woman who's a very strong evaluator and was very happy, Ebony Golden, with the outcome. Second example, we mentioned Zenobia Bailey, also an African-American woman, doing something with that functional art that you heard Rashida describe a bit. And she said to me, I want someone who's not African-American, because part of my interest in this project at this moment is this relevant to other people? It should be, coming with other cultural forms and legacies that can inform the art and culture that they're making, but we would like an evaluator, a field researcher, who will follow our work and ask questions, that they're not a total insider with this kind of work. And then to give just one more example of that before I hope I have a minute to talk about the city project. Oh, is that really over? Oh, okay. Oh, I'm so glad that we learned that song "No Means Yes." In this so this Mark Strandquist and Courtney Bowles right now. I'll just do this. I won't get to talk about this.
That's okay.
They're doing the Philadelphia think tank with formerly incarcerated people. They realized they needed someone who could make a case to public defenders, and so we have just gotten her a lawyer who is committed to social justice work and appreciates art, and who I'll work with, because she won't be as strong in the art articulation. That's not what she does. But I think that opening up who might be the person writing is a good question to pose in this context. Thank you.
Well, and maybe you can actually slide the city project into this question. Maybe not. But you bring up the question of language, which immediately made me think of translation. Because one of the things that has to happen, regardless of who is doing the evaluation, is they have to be able to have a good ear for the work being done, but they also need to be able to speak to funders who, of course, have their own language.
Yeah.
And so how do you grapple with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons it's good we begin assuming that we're bringing in multiple perspectives, because the multiple perspectives that we ask questions of the participants, the artists, the organization, the funder, you know, ourselves, et cetera, that right away, we know what some of the questions and issues are, and I think that brings us into those languages. Take, for example, our work with New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, where we work with Veterans Affairs, and thank you. She thought I was hilarious. It's a rare comment I get, but I'm always happy for it. Children's Services and Immigrant, the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. In talking with them and in their, the people from the first 3 months of those, it's public artists in residence, the first 3 months of that work with the city, the artists are spending time with staffs of those agencies and they're learning each other's languages. So of course we know that this kind of work takes more time, but that's fine. That's partly why we get the experiences that the first panel talked about that's so seminal to the work being effective, is that you have an experience, which means you've taken some time to build some relationships and come up with a common language.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pam?
All right. So I know I'm going to get the axe too, so Jan, don't feel bad. I'm Pam Corza. I co-direct the Animating Democracy Program at Americans for the Arts. We've been working for a number of years to strengthen the role of arts and culture in civic dialogue, in civic engagement, and in social justice. And for several years, for several years, with some initial support from the Kellogg Foundation, we began to explore, as Steve mentioned, these questions of how do you really understand what difference you're making in the social and civic space. And so I'm just going to tease you with one framework that I won't be sharing today, but our continuum of impact was an initial step to try to define, based on research, the sort of overarching families of social outcomes that typically cultural workers are striving to achieve, if not contributing to at some level to achieving them. And so we're actually now in the process of refreshing this framework as well, and you can find it in its present state on our website. But really, the question for today is why have we chosen to actually try to create an aesthetics framework, and what does that look like? We've valued the role of art since day one of our work at Animating Democracy, and questions like what makes the creative work work, as Steve has mentioned, what makes it excellent as art at the same time that it's doing social good. And so the framework really responds to some of the challenge points that we've often heard artists express about misunderstanding or limited understanding of that work. Assumptions, for example, that artistic quality is secondary or sometimes compromised by social intent. The fact that Eurocentric standards have tended to dominate in all kinds of spheres, whether it's the funding sphere or partners in community spaces, et cetera. The critique that the work lacks artistic rigor, often because it's based in community process. Those kinds of things have led us to the goals that you see on this particular slide for the framework that we're developing. So how did it get to come to be? We put together an evaluation learning lab that took place over about a year and a half in collaboration with the Nathan Cummings Foundation and the Arts, Culture, and Social Justice Network. We brought together about 20 artists, funders, and evaluators to talk together about the practical challenges of assessing this work and what movement forward any of them had made to that point in time and what questions still remained. And the real charge of the group was to try and come up with a couple of practical frameworks, and the aesthetics framework is one of them. So really driven by the desire to put artists in the forefront in defining what qualities, aesthetic qualities, artistic qualities, they feel are important and help to contribute to strong and effective work, they came up with 11 attributes. And this was a sort of subgroup of the overall lab that did this work. And I'm just going to kind of breeze through these. You have them in this handout. There are two handouts that I've distributed. And what you should know is the framework isn't exactly done yet. It's in design, so you're getting sort of sample pages from various iterations of the framework. So I'll dwell on a few of these and then just sort of breeze through the rest. Fundamental, we believe, and the artists believe, is a commitment to social change, to an understanding of the issues at hand. That commitment needs to be backed up by knowledge and intention. And so a question, you know, you might ask is, to what extent is commitment underpinning the creative work? There are many questions that the artists came up with for each of these attributes, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Communal meaning. Arts for Change values individual experience, but it's also about delivering a shared experience that has significance and meaning for the participants. So how do the creative processes and products help people to see intersections, make connections, whether it's through the creative process of making work or dialogue related to the work or other kinds of engagement strategies? Disruption is often core to this work. It can relate to both form and content. It should always carry the question, how do we disrupt, not for disruption's sake, but for what purpose? What are we really trying to achieve through that disruption? Cultural integrity. If the goal is justice, then things like authenticity and integrity and truth are inherent in this kind of work. And so this attribute examines and unpacks how artists and stakeholders need to explore issues of power, privilege, and cultural context. And then the rest of these, I'll just kind of give you a moment in silence to look at the rest of these.
Rather, you have at least 45 seconds.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Risk-taking. Sensory experience. Openness. Resourcefulness. Coherence. And stickiness. So I'll just leave you with a couple of things. The framework itself plays out each of these attributes with a description that helps to anchor it in social justice and social change work and its relationship to that, a set of reflective questions that are meant to probe and be a place for inquiry about each attribute, and then some project examples that help to illuminate them. We're very conscious of not trying to create the next set of buzzwords that we hope people will start to deploy in whatever their spheres are, but rather to use this as a guide. That one doesn't quite look like it's supposed to. And what you have is a copy of a Funder Companion, which was created by Chris Dwyer from RMC Research, who does a lot of work with social justice and arts funders. And this is a sort of entry point into the framework. It may give you some ideas of how it will relate to your work. And there are actually companion guides for others as well. And is Sarah Reisman in the room? Sarah. So Sarah created the curator companion for the guide as well. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. So here's a question, and I think it's a question I could ask to anybody on this panel, but I think I'm going to ask it to you. Why are we all concerned with what practitioners think?
Why not? I mean, this is the source of the work. And so I think, you know, what we forget is that there is a huge history and body of work that backs up the current moment of arts and social change work, and that the disciplines, the creative disciplines, as well as sort of interdisciplinary thinking have informed this work over time. And so there's theory behind the practice, there's experience behind the practice, and who better to know kind of what the nature of the work is and how to think about it when it works. They're probably the first ones to observe that. They may not know how to measure it, but there is an experience level there that really informs the work. So our theory has always been practice to theory, really, to look at the practitioner's work and their thinking about it as a way to understand what makes it work and how it's effective.
Thank you. It seems like actually a very good segue to you, George.
Okay, thank you. I think I keep going down, right?
You can use this.
What am I doing?
Use that.
Okay.
No, you're going the right way. They just had a lot of my slides.
There we go.
Is that you?
One more. There we go. Hi, guys. George Perlov, as introduced, and I married a German and moved to Brussels about a year and a half ago. Little did I know I was going to be a political refugee at the time, but it's been interesting times here and there. And I have to say, I met the Steves at a communications network conference, which is a conference of foundation communications people a couple of years ago. And I saw them present about artistic activism, and it was sort of like being the kid who goes to the circus, and you want to join the circus. And I said, and you've had that feeling, and I was like, I want to join the circus.
I like clowns.
And so it's been fantastic. And this question came up, and I said, wow, this is so cool, and how do you measure it? And then they were like, well. And then there was a long conversation about that. And then we've been got some funding from Soros and some other groups to help us.
British Council.
And
Compton.
And Compton Foundations to help us start to look at this project and have bigger ambitions going forward, which we'll talk about in a second. But the first thing that we did was actually look at a literature review of this field. And I don't have, if you're interested in it, we can certainly send it to you. The literature review summary is fairly short. There's an annotated bibliography that we have that's a bit longer that really looks at all the different documents we were approached here. And what I'll say is that, you know, we started to look at this from the perspective of activists using arts and creativity. And there's a lot written more about the idea of artists, you know, who want to bring activism into their work. And you'll see definitely in this a lot of the great work that Pam and the group at Animated Democracy have done, and some of the great work that Deborah and Jan at ABOG have done. So you'll see a lot of that reflected in there. But there was some really good learning. But then we had like a lot of questions about that. And that led us to develop, to do some research among practitioners. And these are people who basically train artists, train activists to use the arts and creativity in their work. Many of whom are active artists themselves. And I'll just give you, you have a handout actually that has the report in it, and I'll just give you a quick few, a little overview of some of the key things we learned. And it comes back to, you know, again, it's like, you know, when I was at the Ad Council, when I first started there, we had a lot of people who, on our board and our advisory committee from the ad research world, and we were always looking at how do we measure the impact of our work, and we were looking at all these metrics and measures and models from the advertising world. And I said, well, look, guys, wait a minute. We're talking about social issues here. We're not talking about Coca-Cola. I mean, basically, I mean, not to bash the advertising world, but, you know, you put up an ad that says Coca-Cola six times on it, and people come up, what do you remember about this ad? People say Coca-Cola. But, you know, we were dealing with very difficult and challenging social issues, and we were dealing with in the practice of social media, of donated media. So we were not getting, you know, these ad runs, multi-million. You know, we were lucky if we were getting, you know, a little piece of that. And coming to this project, it was again sort of looking at these sort of saying, like, how do we apply some learning here that's going to be relevant and useful? And just asking a lot of, I was very curious, and as were the Steves, about how we're, can you not hear me? Oh, I'm sorry. Is that better? Yes? Okay, I'm tall. Okay. There we go. Is that better? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for letting me know. You know, we were just curious about how, how do we apply some of these questions. And so that's what this research was about. And one of the things, you know, we asked first off was, you know, about theory of change. You know, how do you think about theory when you go into a project? Is there some sort of theory of change? Is there some idea that you're using? And most of these people I spoke to, I'd say, had some sort of, there was a strategy that they had. They were very focused on the word, on strategy and planning. But there wasn't that sort of picture of, you know, the utopia or dystopia or whatever they were trying to create at the end here. There wasn't that same sense of what that would look like. And oftentimes, you know, especially because these were mostly people who were training activists, they did use a lot of community organizing theory. They used a lot of existing work that was in the field, and basically were adapting it to their needs. And also there's some focus for some groups on getting media attention. And media attention, and this will come to in a second when I talk about media metrics, is great, because oftentimes these interventions, what you're really looking for is the media to pick it up. But then the question is, where does that lie in the spectrum of actual ultimate impact? So I'll come back to that in a second. Oops. So I'll talk very quickly now, because I'm a New Yorker native. And the other point that I want to talk about was goal setting and strategic planning can be very challenging as well, because A, there are so many goals, you know, so many things are changing in the world as activists are working on a lot of issues. You know, all of a sudden they realize, oh my goodness, we're working on this cause, but everything's just sort of shifted. What do we do? Or they realize, you know, they're doing a lot of really interesting interventions, and then at the end of it, they say, well, wait a minute, did that really have an impact? Who is the audience we're really trying to reach here? What were we really trying to say? Was it really important? Did the creative process get ahead of us in some ways here? So that's a challenge. Metrics, as I say here, it is a word that got a lot of people upset when I brought them up. People talked about the nonprofit evaluation industrial labor complex, thank you, you know, which they felt was could be really challenging to the process. Like, why does everything have to be measured? Why does this always have to happen? And yet at the same time, I think secretly they're all saying, I want to be effective. Why can, you know, how can we do this? How do we work this into what we're doing? And oftentimes it was they didn't have the time, the knowledge, or the resources to really know what was the best way to move forward here. And especially social media, which I'll talk about for a second, is great. You know, it was like, love the social media metrics, hate the social media metrics. It's great because you have so much information. Immediately you can reach huge amounts of people. And yet at the same time, it's like, what does it mean? And what do you do with this? And how do you apply this to your learning? So there are a lot of challenges relating to metrics. And lastly, I'll just sort of say the point is what we're looking for here is what's needed is capacity building. I think there is definitely an interest in the field to do more, to have more at hand, because I think everybody wants to know. Everyone wants, obviously, you know, we're spending money, we're spending people's time, we're spending passion of people in the field. How do we show that this is really working? So there was definitely interest in that. And definitely in toolkits, which is something that we are looking to develop coming out of this, is toolkits for funders, for activists, and for artists to be able to use in very, and especially for the artists and the activists, in very sort of simple, easy-to-use language, and in ways that will help them just be smarter and bring a little bit of this into the beginning planning process, because that's what we found often enough, is that there wasn't this sort of end result planning piece going into it. So those are my few comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Since you come from a not necessarily an activist world, although in your own personal life, yes, and not an art world, but actually a marketing world, do you find that there are things that we can use from the fields of marketing, political polling? I mean, there's a lot of very smart people doing a lot of evaluative research out there. What did you find that was useful that we could borrow and perhaps adapt and adopt to think about measurement, think about evaluation, think about things like that? Or is it all completely, apples and oranges?
No, I think the key thing I've always learned, and I've done a lot of work in marketing and in the world of social marketing, and social marketing being behavior change, not social media marketing, but also incorporate social media marketing at times. But I think the really key things are like audience, you know, barriers and opportunities. You know, who are your audiences? What are the barriers to reaching them? And what are the opportunities for bringing them in? And so many times, you know, we forget about that. Also, just the idea of competition. Because people are, you know, there's a lot of competition out there, and especially in the area of social marketing, I always talk to clients about this. Doing nothing is a very big thing for most. Most people will do nothing. That is your competition. And how do we, we just assume people are going to want to do something, but you know, doing something is a big deal for people. And so, how do you actually get them off the couch and doing something? And that's what a lot of the activist work is all about.
Thank you. And finally, Risa?
I am not a microphone person. So before I launch in, here's what I'd like to understand. If you're able to, can you show me by raising your hands, who's already investing in this work, in this room? Like, hi. So kind of 50%. Okay. So if you said yes, I'm curious, how many of you have been funding this work for the last 20 years? 15. 1. 20? 20-ish? Like you. Okay. Yeah? All right. I like it. 15? 10? Okay. A little longer. 5. Okay. And the last 1 or 2 years. Very interesting. Okay, that's helpful. So, I am not gonna talk about who I am, because you did that already. And so, what I will say is, as someone who created an arts organization, where it was a radical act at the time to put a table in front of a laundromat and try to engage people who are passing by, right, to think of this as an outdoor studio, to think about this as a public square, right? I had to answer a lot of very, in my opinion, stupid questions about the value of art, about the role of artists, about social return on, you know, investment, and to this point of metrics and evaluation, had to filter what should have been a very generative process through data and through quantifying something that isn't about quantifying something, right? And so that trauma has helped me to be a better funder, right? To be thoughtful about what is actually required inside of this space. And so in that frame, I'm going to trouble our presence here, which is that I so appreciate the kind of funder education that this entire experience is, and I want to problematize our need to be educated about this practice, right, without actually doing some metrics of our own effectiveness, right? Because the questions we should be asking, or what should be driving our understanding of all this work is, how do we do our work better? Like, what's the support required for any of this to be effective, right? You know, Deborah, you're talking about jobs, right? The economy is real. You know, multi-year support versus project support, mm-hmm. you know, unrestricted funds versus, you know, project mm-hmm. support. Creating space for capacity building, for time and space. I actually think so many people are resistant to these measures, not because, to your point, that they don't want to have impact, but because I'm too busy doing the work. If you want to pay me to have some time and space to think about why we do what we do, how we do it, in the best language, happily I'll do that, right? But in the meantime, I'm trying to get it done. Yeah. It's your business, what you want to call it.
Right.
Now, that being said, because that's the way our economy works, it is important what we call it. And, you know, you alluded to it, the Steves alluded to it in the sort of first slide, that there's this continuum, and for the purposes of today, we're talking about it as artistic activism. But there are so many freaking names, right? Okay? And they all mean something different. Right? So relational aesthetics and participatory art making is not the same as creative placemaking, is not the same as artistic activism, is not the same as legislative art, is not the same as someone who is not so much driven by an issue, but is driven by a group of people that wants to figure out how to improve the quality of life for that particular group, whether that's a race, whether that's geography. It's all contextual. And if we don't actually have that fluency, then we're not in a position to evaluate this work, right? Like, it's not enough to sort of, it's important that we ask the folks who are doing it, tell me how you want me to understand this work. And we also have to do the labor of putting that work into a larger context,
yeah.
right? And why all this matters is because all of this is loaded by an art sector, right? If we were talking about shifting power, an art sector that has a foundation of a power of margin and center, like literally is the tool of hegemony,
yes.
right? And in that frame, this is an area of work that has been indigenous to the most vulnerable communities. You know, has been indigenous to the people that needed this to save their lives, right? So people of color, right? Immigrants, right? People living on low incomes. But we don't talk about that, right? We don't get specific. We say art and artwork, right? And so if we're not being specific about that, then what happens is the folks who have the clearest fluency in the majority language are able to then gather the resources because they can describe the impact, but the people who have been doing this for their survival don't speak that language, don't necessarily call themselves artists, aren't going to deal with any of these frameworks, right? Mm-hmm. And so those resources continue not to flow,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So this is the heavy lift for us to do. I mean, you know, this has all been good content, but if we walk away from here and think, oh, great, now we have some frameworks to, you know, to think about this work, and we don't do it in a larger analysis of our own sector and our own practice, it will only reinscribe the same behaviors that I found I was pushing up against 15 years ago. And what a loss that would be. Because we have come so far, as Rashida has said. You know, it is now normal to work this way. And there is more and more artists who want to enter this space, whether they are still in school, whether they're in an apprenticeship space, or whether they have established careers and want to figure out how to make meaning for their neighbors and not just for art patrons, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the heavy lift. I'm gonna stop.
Woo!
Yes.
Since we are all busy, but let's assume the best and we're interested in a counter-hegemonic project.
Okay.
What would be the thing, the first step, that funders should do in order to educate themselves, in order to evaluate themselves, in order to see themselves in a productive capacity, and particularly helping those who don't have the funder's language, don't occupy those worlds, and so on and so forth. But actually, and this is something, you know, I hope is a given, you alluded to it, is that artistic activism, no matter what you call it, has always been the possession of those without access to legal fields, educational fields, policy worlds, and so on and so forth. This is the strength of this practice. But how do we get from here to there, or there to here,
mm-hmm.
actually?
So I have a straightforward answer, but it's not an easy answer. So because this is endemic to our sector and our structure, I think it's a larger project around equity, right? So it matters who's in the room, it matters who's on staff, it matters who's a trustee, it matters who is on the selection panel, it matters who your networks are in terms of identifying candidates. Whether you have a nominations process, whether you have an open call, whether it's by invitation. I think as long as we are doing a very thorough inventory of the degree to which we built out organization cultures, practices, structures that actually draw in as many voices as possible, right? And if we haven't done that, then we need to build that out, right? Because that makes it possible in whatever different program areas we are trying to work within. That's straightforward. I recognize it's not easy, but I also think that it needs to be normalized in the space of philanthropy. And there are a lot of pioneering organizations right now who are doing that equity work, who are doing racial equity trainings, who are really trying to look at their structures and maybe thinking about diversity. But it needs to be the new norm. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. And thank you to this amazing panel. And now, want to open up the questions. I think we'll follow the format of the first panel, which is take two or three questions, and then whoever on the panel feels moved to answer those questions, do so.
I'm Michael Royce with the NYFA, the New York Foundation for the Arts. And this is not so much a question, and I hope that I'm able to put my words together to actually say what I want to say, because it's really a request to the funders in the room. And that is,
can you put on the mic?
Your
microphone,
yes, it is.
Sure. Do you hear me now? Okay. All right, so we've been working with immigrant artists for 10 years now. And as a grantee, we have to come up with language. And so we use the word social practice. And we've been using it for like 2 years now because it became in vogue to use those words. But we've been doing it for 10 years. We never actually called it anything. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when we talk about this particular work, there is the question from funders about the impact and how do you evaluate it and the metrics. And what I would like to request is that funders actually, and I know everyone is so busy, I get it, I really do, but go see what's happening. It's an experiential impact. It's not necessarily a data impact. And if you go see the work, I think you may ask that question less. So I just want to put that out there.
That's yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So to make the some of these issues very concrete, I'd love responses to two categories of trustee response. One is, I know what funding good art means, and I'm not going to hold it to too high a measurable impact standard. But I don't know how to think about this kind of art. And the second is, I'm really intrigued by the impact of this kind of art, and I want to understand, you know, how to measure that impact, which we've talked a little bit about. But my response to both is, do traditional arts funders of museums and performing arts ask either of those questions?
Take one more question, and then. All the way in back.
Karen Rose of the Walton Foundation. One thing that struck me when you were asking the questions about who funds this is that there's a continuum of what people fund that is might be somewhere on this spectrum. And in some ways, we have to bring people along. I don't want to say slowly, but they need to understand, the trustees need to understand. And you mentioned the grant. I didn't raise my hand at all. But Groundswell was mentioned. People that we do fund were mentioned, but I don't think of them in that way. So there might be some educational work around that.
I'm going to just hold it there, and then you two are going to be the next in queue. Anybody want to respond?
Go ahead, just start, please.
No. Well, and just a clarifying question, are we being webcast?
Is that what's happening right now?
No.
It's an audio recording.
Excellent. Okay, great. I'm just saying, I'd like to keep my job. So, you know. Just asking.
But it's going to be available online.
No, understood. Okay. Understood.
You're worried about how you dress?
No.
You're doing great.
Just trying to be thoughtful about language. Thinking about David's question, thinking about Lucas's question. In some ways, I find that trying to make the case for this kind of work inside of the art sector, whether it is a trustee at an arts-based foundation, versus trying to make the argument to someone who is maybe in a different sector or from a justice perspective, is harder. Yeah. Didn't think that that was possible.
Yeah.
But because, the nature of those institutions were built on a very particular, not just brand of art making in terms of the object themselves, but function of the art, which was about reinforcing hierarchies, wealth, elitism, right? Those are deeply entrenched values that people don't even realize are part of what makes them feel good when they look at something, right? Or go to a piece of theater or whatever it is. And so the very nature of this work is about disrupting those ideas, and it's hard to voluntarily say, I really like that. I like that thing that's saying how I feel is really problematic. Am I powerful? Do you know what I mean? And so the trustee education that you're pulling up, I mean, we got to do some creative problem solving here, right? How do you lead somebody to their own medicine? I don't have the answer. Just raising the question.
I want to just say a couple of things about education. First of all, on the level of formal education, I so agree with you. I taught for many years at NYU, and that's where people used to pat me on the head and say how nice it was what I did. And I thought, not particularly nice. but since that's one of the funnels through which people become artists and audiences and funders and educators, it's really important that some of the work happens in academia. I think that I was really weak that way. All I wanted to do was get my students out of the university into the community, and yet It's just as important what you do in the university. So there's formal education. Then there's informal education, opportunities to come together and learn together, especially sometimes, you know, a group which is largely funders like this, a group that's somewhat homogenous, but also cross-sector. It's so exciting to get to be learning with people in informal situations, and you find out directly what people know from the, as bell hooks put it, authority of their experience. Mm-hmm. That's the only way you find it out, and that's very exciting. And then the third thing I wanted to say is writing and scholarship. Again, I hate when we make academic totally the bad guy, academia, because it's not. For one thing, that's one of the places we can have those jobs to be artists. And for another thing, it all depends how you occupy academia. So how you write and who you want to disseminate to and who you mix it up with so your students learn a different way of thinking about art than they would have otherwise. So it's so both formal, informal, and how we meet in between.
I want to talk a little bit about how funders can think about self-education and education in a variety of ways. Sometimes I think funders learn best from their peers. Case studies about practice that's going on in grant making in this realm of work, I think, could be really, really informative. Animating Democracy made an initial step in that direction. I wish we had funding to do more, but 5 or 6 case studies on our site of funders who, at various points of their own trajectory in this work, sort of talk about what it took them to get to that place of exploring it, how they explored it, how they brought their trustees on board with it, et cetera, et cetera. I think affinity groups are beginning more and more to take initiative themselves. GIA, Grantmakers in the Arts, I think has done that in part through its conferences by really being open to practitioners being present in the room in not just a sort of token way, but in a significant way. And they bring a lot to the conversation from direct experience. In June, I'll be going and talking with the Bay Area Justice Funders Network, which comes together on its own steam frequently to talk about issues of funding justice work, but many of those funders are also crossover in the arts realm as well, and so their own affinity conversations are really building the sort of muscle and the idea base for how they approach their work. And the third thing that I want to say is the role of sort of experimental laboratories for learning to happen. In our own experience, we started with a field lab when we had our Kellogg Foundation support that brought that paired evaluators with artists and arts organization leaders who had project work at hand where they wanted to understand how could we actually approach evaluation in a way that's meaningful to us as the practitioner, what we want to learn, what we want to find out. And at the same time, evaluators who are predisposed to want to work in this arena also need to get close to the work. There's a theory of change about this support infrastructure or system to really come at it from different angles so that funders, evaluators, and artists are in the same room often, really talking together about how to make it work, how to make evaluation not an imposition, but a shared and collaborative process where everybody gets to learn something that's important to them. So I really believe strongly in the role of labs and coaching to support the kind of toolkits that George brought up. Toolkits aren't really enough. I'm not convinced that our framework just planted on people's desks will make a whole lot of difference without ways to actually enact it and work with it and have exchange around it, because it's not a perfect tool. It will only apply the way that you want to use it.
I was just going to add to this point. One of the questions I was, you know, asking people about, you know, what are the measures, the metrics that you use or think should be, you know, used more in the field, and I think these would be of real interest to funders, are questions like, you know, did we create some new meaning? What did we create narrative change? These are things, you know, that funders get excited about. Are there new players that were brought in because of the work that we did? Did we uplift the morale of groups that are working, you know, on these areas that may have had some morale issues in the past? And did we create some new identities? And these are all things that I think are very interesting, you know, of great interest to funders. And I think that these practitioners are really interested in it, but they feel like, I don't know how to measure that. I don't know quite how to do that. And I think it's not that difficult. You know, I think if you go into it, then that's the big part of it, is the going into it with the thought of, if those are the things that we want to see coming out of this work, how do we start to plan now to think about how we're going to measure that at the end?
You know, I come at this from a very different place. I'm an activist, and I'm interested in art because I think it can actually bring about social change. And so part of me gets always a little leery when we start saying, well, they're artists, we should just listen to them, and we should, which is what we, I mean, and in our own work, that's what we're doing, right, is because we do believe in a metrics from the bottom up. But in the end of the day, if this doesn't create social change, I'm not that interested in it, right? And that's really one of the things, this is why metrics matter, is not just so foundations can check it off and say, did it work, did it not work, can we write that in some sort of grant, but because the stakes here are huge, that if you're going to talk about arts for social change, then you have to take the social change part really seriously. Otherwise, you're using social change as the content for your art, as opposed to the end. And so I think that what I really want to impress upon us is, this is difficult stuff. This is really hard stuff. It makes us uncomfortable, but we have to do it.
Can I just build on that?
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point. And I think, one, it's important that when we hold artists accountable to that, it is because that they have articulated that that is their intention and goal. And that part of what is so rich here is in putting forward frameworks, tools, language for the field to actually poke at and add to and decide if they agree with, so that, because artists are generative thinkers, it's sort of like, what? It's about social change, you know? I mean, you know, right? That's what happens, is it becomes this sort of fluid space and definition, and not realizing that by saying that, you are now going to be held accountable to the shift that you create, which is important. I think you're absolutely right. And then the other layer on here is the nature of arts and culture is that it's a correlative process and not a causative process, right? It's not like you can say, oh, because I did this art project, now the entire community has, you know, great health, right? Like, you can't do that. It may be true. It may be true, but it's not like it's an input-output system, right? And so even as we talk about holding artists accountable to their participation in processes for change, we have to be really fluent in what the processes for change actually look like, that they are long trajectories, that this is one element in a whole series of elements that gets to that change, and that part of their contributions can be catalysts for that change, can be new lenses to redirect the way that activists might have been approaching their campaign or what have you. But the point is that it's not about, I don't think any of us are saying that artists are single-handedly spectators, to use Katie's term, right? And superheroes who are going to do this by themselves. Right, getting really precise in our shared language as a field so that we can hold each other accountable.
Can I jump in? I just to one point on that, the causative, not correlative, and all of that. I think, look for example at what Katie was telling us about this great work that they've done with the city councils and groups like that. And, you know, I put my marketing hat back on, and we say, you know what, let's try this. Let's do a, you know, a randomized experiment. We'll do like two or three different tests you know, in a couple of different markets and cities and see how it works, and we won't do it in another city and see, you know, with that are looking at similar legislation. Obviously, yes, you'd have a lot to control for here, but why not? You know, and that's the beauty of research, being a, you know, a research nerd, is that, you know, you can apply it to some interesting experiments like this. So I think that there are opportunities to, you know, and this comes back to the scaling up question, because I'm working with a client now in Europe that's trying to scale up its social health related training work that they do. And you know, it's again, you know, you can start to make the case that if you have some of these examples, and you have rigorous methods that you've used to do that, you can really scale these things up. And some of these are not so difficult to measure.
Yes, you had your hand up.
Hello, everybody. Stephen Pacheco again from the David Rockefeller Fund. And so, correct me on my pronunciation. Risa Wilson.
Risa.
Sorry. So to build on what you were saying just now, in terms of, get my words together. Okay, so in terms of basically wanting something that is actually going to have some sort of sustainable impact, I want to know what, and I understand I'm in a room full of funders, so I don't have to express, like, this comes with a lot of risk-taking. I know that everybody in here knows that. How willing is the field to actually fail? Because the greatest risk, I'll speak from an artistic standpoint, I think that is, like, at the heart of artistic creation,
right?
Willing to be vulnerable and put everything on the line and somebody say, nah, try again. And it's like, well, I'm gonna try again, you know. And so, like, how accepting is the field of loss? And then to that point, if the field is more accepting than I hope, how many shots will we give something? Because I personally believe, nobody has to agree, but I feel strongly that life is amorphous. And so change is obviously amorphous, because change is a part of life. And so I'll use myself as an example, where me coming into a lot of these spaces now, people will ask me, well, you know, what did you get out of that experience? I'm 27 years old. I have no problem aging myself. So, and it's not because I'm young. It's that can actually work in a reverse manner in this setting. But it's like that I might not be able to tell you until I'm 30, 40. So for you to, and I'm not saying anybody's doing this, but for you to write off that there was no impact,
right,
it can kind of be premature. Like, how do we measure that? Are we thinking about measuring that? So those are my questions. I'm sorry, it's like three.
Yeah.
Open to everybody.
I was also just going to ask about failure. So thank you. Yeah, great.
I would love to hear people just talk a little bit more, if you wouldn't mind, about the difference between impact and effectiveness.
That's great.
Could we get a little bit deeper into that question?
Well, can you say who you are?
Ella. from the sorry, this is the way you asked it.
From the Mellon Foundation.
Thank you. One more question?
Yeah, so this might be opening can of worms we don't have time for, but I'm just curious, in this conversation about social practice, social change, right, and arts, we had an experience where we were applying to the Ford Foundation, their Good Neighbor Committee, who were not big enough for their big grants, and we, for Covenant House work, and we wrote in our legislative theater work as part of what that troupe might be involved in, and they came back to us and said, our lawyers say you have to take out any reference of legislative theater from this whole grant, and we've gotten kind of scared from that experience, and we're also trying to figure out where we exist right now in nonprofits, right? We work a lot with council members, we're like, we're dancing on some fences, but I'm curious about that, and if you all, your foundations have policies that, I don't know, that are going to relate to what we're trying to talk about.
Yeah.
All right. Unfortunately, we're going to take this badge, and then I think that might be it. So actually, let's get really quick, since you have not spoken.
Hi, I'm Keto. I wear a lot of hats. This is my third Wave Fund board member hat. When we were relaunching the fund a few years ago, we did a lot of thinking and listening to our grantees, which are youth-led gender justice groups, grassroots activism, which I think is kind of in the same realm as the kind of art that we're talking about funding here. And I just wanted to offer out a couple of the things that we thought about, because we changed our grant-making strategies and how we did it very deeply. So, number one, all decisions are made by a panel of peers. They get the say, they can read the proposals the most. The applications can be submitted by a video selfie or even through an interview with our program officer, if that's what they have the capacity for. And the third thing I wanted to mention is that our funding streams, we shifted those as well to be more responsive to what people actually need. So the two funds that we have active now, one of them is rapid response. So it's once a month, we make decisions around that and we get money out as quickly as we can. And the other one is a 6-year-long funding program for really strong, emerging, young leadership that we're like, we're just going to invest in you because you rule, and we're going to stick with you for a while and see you through the process of growth. So that was what we came up with as we listened to our grantees over time.
Sure. Well, one thing that the failure, very good failure question makes me think about is, what did you learn from the failure? And if we frame part of what we're all working on as what we learned, because of course it's iterative. We do something, we reflect on it, we say, oh, I see, that wasn't the best idea because XYZ, why don't we try this now? That's perfectly, it's part of a process that may be very successful. So again, we have to change our timeline. Mm-hmm. In our thinking. I feel like I just keep thinking that during this whole conversation. Also, I sometimes feel like artists who do social change work are held to a higher standard than, like, you know, social justice lawyers or equitable community development people. Why is that? Nobody can do it single-handedly, including artists. And so I think it helps when artists recognize they're in partnerships, but it also helps when funders and the partners do. And then Katie with... It's sort of the thing of the silos. I mean, to me, that's one of the fabulously exciting things about having Tom Finkelpearl as the cultural commissioner. You know, the fact that he's doing these projects, he's mixing it all up. And so I feel that, you know, sometimes, even if it's a small amount of money, it's very important symbolically. And so I think it's really important that we have a cultural commissioner who's putting in, who's talking to his cultural commission, his peers in other agencies, and they're saying, yeah, we offer a lot at the Mayor's Office of Immigration, but a lot of the immigrants don't use that. Why is that? And then it gets into relationship building and what it is that an artist can do to help carry out the initiative that the Office of Immigrant Affairs wants to in this case. So this whole thing of mixing it up, and we need the models, and we need them to be out in the world through education and writing and journals, and I think of ecosystem. We have to remember all the different places where the one piece of work can then have a good influence in changing the ecosystem, making the world safe for legislation coming in the theater company.
The question about what's the difference between impact and effectiveness, I'm not sure I have the answer, but, and I always in these forums admit right off the bat that I'm not a trained evaluator or researcher, but we've hung out with a lot of those folks, especially the ones that are sensitized to this kind of work, and often hear that the word impact is used pretty sparingly by those in the evaluation field to mean that sort of sometimes even unreachable point that you strive for always, the kind of ultimate change that down the road you aspire for. And sometimes those translate to long-term goals in other language that's used. But the notion of effectiveness often comes into play in the sort of more incremental steps or the progress toward that ultimate goal. So when we developed the continuum of impact, it was in large response to having done some grant making ourselves in our early years and seeing the kind of lofty aspirations that many cultural workers have that aren't really achievable through a single project. And yet, there are contributions that can be made, whether it's raising knowledge and awareness at one end of that continuum, changing public discourse or who participates in that discourse, building civic civic capacity and the ability to work toward change, changes in behavior or actually motivating action, and then changes in condition and policy at the other end of the spectrum. You can make progress at any one of those points through a singular project. You may, as an activist, really see a sequential relationship from one end of that spectrum to another. But I think that notion of effectiveness, the notion of impact needs to often be recalibrated to what's realistic in the context of the change that you're trying to make, the resources that you have at hand, the project that can be played out. Where do you want to focus that energy?
Wow, thank you.
two other cents on impact and effectiveness. And I know when I was at the Ad Council, I mean, oftentimes we would define effectiveness as, did we meet the goal of the campaign? The campaign had a very specific goal, whether we wanted to raise awareness of childhood hunger or et cetera, et cetera. And if we had metrics to show we've done that, that was great. Impact was a little looser for us, I think, and that often meant, you know, something happened that was in the process. Like we learned that I think the in the area of like child hunger, that one of a program that was not normally planning, that was not expected to be refunded, was refunded because we heard that actually a guy at one of the government agencies had seen the commercial and was talking about it, and that was part of his decision to make this change. So we thought, wow, that's great. Or I worked recently with a project in Brussels with a major arts presenter there on a civic engagement project that used the arts. And their whole focus was, you know, we want to see, you know, students have much better, stronger feeling about Europe and what it means to be European. And, you know, they get so involved with Europe there. And then, you know, the bottom line was, what did the students learn? What came out of it was, like, they actually found that the students were able to express their opinions well, which was something they never had really done before. They found that a lot of the underserved students who would come to this organ, this was like the, it's called Bozar, which is, if you know it, it's like the Carnegie Hall and Brooklyn Museum put together in one place, that students had never been to this place before. And that they, you know, just the fact that, you know, as an immigrant, as coming from an immigrant family, to come to be in a place like this was for them a terrific achievement. So that's, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to talk about these things.
So there's two things I want to offer, and one is a question out to the room. But the first thing is just talking about this failure frame, right? And I was really moved by your description of OSF's work, right, around working on lost causes.
Yeah.
That is delicious. I mean, truly. Like, I think that you need to get on a megaphone and roam around, right? Data. Because I think, you know, part of why this is even thought of as a big bet, and there is this risk and failure language, is because it's scarcity thinking, right? We have finite resources to meet so many needs, and, you know, art feels frivolous. So this is already a big bet to even think that it has this level of value, and then is this actually going to do the thing that it says it's going to do? And I think that frame of working on lost causes is more about nourishment, right? Like, what are the things that can help move us forward? Doesn't expect us to get the ball all the way down the field, but understands that these investments move this along. And if that was a shared frame, I think there would be more openness to just try and to see misses as, you know, failing forward, you know, and part of the process, as opposed to, you didn't give me the return on my investment, right? The second thing I want to ask of the room is, I'm curious about the appetite for this kind of funder learning. Like, if there was a gathering to actually investigate how we are applying these ideas inside of our practice. Curious who in the room, you know, time, you know, resources permitting, would show up to that. Show of hands. Raise a hand. Like it, love it, great to know. Okay, let's talk.
And I think this is the I'm trying to sort of tie some of things both. This seem to be very different, failure and impact and effect. But I think what I've heard on the panel is actually that one of the things that art does is it has a surplus of effect. That is, art is always generating effects and affects which we did not intend for. And so one of the ways to think about this is about how do we think about the unthinkable? And how do we actually make room for the things that are going to happen that we don't expect to happen? How do we actually, the great thing about the arts, and you know, I was thinking about Audre Lorde here, is it allows us to say things which are unsayable. It allows us to think things which are unimaginable. Yet still, we need to think about those unthinkable things and create spaces for our funders, for people like us who need to be funded, to actually experiment with that, because a lot of the time that takes a lot of risk and oftentimes it fails, but in those failures are the seeds of a new beginning. On that note, I just want to applaud everybody on this panel for an amazing I'm going to turn it over to Brett for a couple of final words. Oh, and I'm going to turn it over to Rashida for some final words. It says Brett.
So not Rashida, any final word for the final words are really just to say thank you. And thank you all for spending this morning with us, which is really invaluable and hopefully the start of many new collaborations, partnerships, conversations. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank the people who made this morning possible. Thank you so much to Lauren Augusta from the Arts Exchange. Thank you to Mark, who is one of our IT people here. I'm not sure if he's in the room right now, but made this all work miraculously. I Ching Lin and Jordan Joseph from Philanthropy New York. Julia Krauss from New York Grant Makers in the Arts. Michael Royce from NYFA. Steve Duncombe and C4AA. And then all of the incredible panelists today. So thank you all for coming.